towards the end of the book, you track a couple of things, one being the point at which John Muir, well, there's a couple of really important things that happen to him, one of which is that he gets married and has children, and he decides to sort of be more a part of the established world order, if you will, and he kind of removes himself, not fully, but to some extent, from the full immersion in the natural world and just walking around with bread and a coat, and he gets married to a woman who he loves deeply. He has children, and he makes a living for his family, and he supports them. So he is not just this remote man up on a hill who never, like, made the choices we have all made. He absolutely did all of those things. He just managed to do them both, and he created a life in which he was able to lovingly do them both. So he does this, and at in this time, and he is described as a very loving and joyful and jovial father, and not doom and gloom. And that is a beautiful thing to see, because that really does bring out this dimensionality of this man that I was not aware of previously. And then we get to this part where he becomes the man that we now think of him as, the leader, father, grandfather of what we now know as the environmental movement. And this happens in a couple of ways that you describe nicely. And it was history that, as an educated person, I felt like, why did I not know these dates? Why did I not know this exactly? But they were really important, and it was fascinating for me to read them and to kind of put them in context for myself. So the founding of Yosemite as a national park, the founding of the Sierra Club, they happened within about 2 years of each other, 1890 and 1892. And then his ongoing, sort of till the end of his life, battle over this damming of the Tuolumne River and the Hetch Hetchy Valley, which made me want to just lie down on the floor and either cry or just, yes. Yeah, I don't know what. Yes. Describe that battle and how it ends a little bit, and what you then come away with as this also sort of retrospective view of the environmental movement and where it is now. Again, like another like 3 hour answer that I just asked of you, but let's just try because it's important.
Okay, well, he did spend most of the 1880s raising his family and running the ranch that he had inherited from his wife's father, and doing a great job of it. He made his family financially independent so that if something were to happen to him, they could carry on. He loved them dearly, and he thought this was part of his job. But then in the late 1880s, a editor of the Century Magazine back east, Robert Underwood Johnson, came to visit and said, "Mr. Muir, you know, we need your help." He had become known through his writings from Yosemite Valley in the 1870s, which he sold to the New York Herald Tribune and various other magazines. And Johnson said, "We need more from you." And it was really Robert Underwood Johnson who spurred him to become more active on the national stage as a conservationist. And so he did found the Sierra Club, and they had various activities. But it was not until the good burghers of San Francisco decided they needed a water supply that was free, that was cheap, and that would be good forever.
This sounds so familiar today, doesn't it? Okay,
it really does. And the more things change. And so they decided that even though they had lots of alternatives for water supply for San Francisco that had been well investigated, but the biggest and the cheapest water supply for them was the Tuolumne River that ran through the northern part of what was then Yosemite National Park. And even though the park's charter specifically said, hands off, you can't do anything with anything in this park, they decided, phooey, we'll just buy our way into that water. And so they made an application to the Department of the Interior to dam up the Tuolumne River just below Tuolumne Meadows at the Hetch Hetchy Canyon, which was, by the way, Muir's favorite spot in the Sierra Nevada. He was in love with this place. He'd spent so much time there, and he has lyrical descriptions of it. And they said, we want to dam this place up. And Teddy Roosevelt's Interior Secretary said, you must be kidding. That's against the law. You can't do that. But they kept on pushing, and they kept on buying off politicians. And then Taft became president, and they tried the same thing under Taft. And Taft said, you can't do this. And then they kept on pushing and pushing. And finally – and all this time, by the way, Muir and his fellow members of the Sierra Club were inventing a form of opposition to this land and water grab. The grassroots environmental movement was invented by Muir and the Sierra Club in the early 1900s when things were finally getting serious about it. And all over the country, common people, not senators and governors and so on, but common people joined in the battle to save Hetch Hetchy. And most of the prominent newspapers in the country came out editorially to support Muir's position to save Hetch Hetchy. But the money and the politicians from San Francisco would not give up. And finally, Woodrow Wilson was elected president. And Wilson bought in as a Secretary of Interior, a good buddy of the former mayor of San Francisco who had started all this, James Phelan. And a sheer money and sheer political heft had managed to breach the charter of this national park. And finally in 1913, the bills were passed that gave the city of San Francisco the right to build this huge dam, the O'Shaughnessy Dam, named after the chief engineer of the city of San Francisco. And in his last year, Muir had to watch his beloved valley be ripped apart and the trees felled and the Tuolumne River muddied up as they started their surveying and their removing of the vegetation. And his first biographer, Lenny Marsh Wolfe, imparts the common feeling that it broke his heart, obviously, mm-hmm. and may well have led to his death just a year later. He was 76 years old, which is pretty old for back in those days, 1914, but he was an extraordinarily vigorous, vital man, and it was really before his time, I think. And this had a lot to do with it. So this battle for Hetch Hetchy really jump-started the environmental movement in the United States. But there was something interesting about it. Muir decided, consciously or unconsciously, not to give vent to his full-throated, imminent worldview, because this is a lot for people to digest, this idea that humans aren't in charge and we're not here to subdue the earth. It's a very different worldview than the classic Western worldview. So consciously or unconsciously, he and the Sierra Club decided to just talk about the benefits to humans of having natural areas that they can spend time in and the harm to humans of pollution and destruction of natural areas. In other words, not to contest the anthropocentric
right.
point of view. And the and it didn't work for Hetch Hetchy, obviously, but the environmental movement since and that's proliferated has adopted that strategy of not contesting this anthropocentric worldview and not articulating and advocating in a full-throated way for the imminent worldview.
Right.
And, you know, that's worked reasonably mm-hmm. well for the 100 years. I mean, we've in the 1960s and 70s, a flood of legislation creating the Clean Air Act, mm-hmm. the Clean Water Act, the Environmental Protection Agency. All this stuff happened, and it cleaned up the air in American cities and cleaned up the water. But climate change is such a huge threat, and the fossil fuel industry is such a well-entrenched pillar of modern economies, and they have paid so much money to our representatives in Washington over the years that we've been able to make no important headway,
right.
really, coming to terms with the catastrophe that global warming is presenting to human civilization.
Mm-hmm.
even the December 2015 UN climate conference with all of its agreements and ideals and pledges don't come remotely close to even addressing the problem. And people such as Naomi Klein, an extremely knowledgeable journalist who wrote This Changes Everything in 2014, and thoughtful observers like Pope Francis in his environmental encyclical in the summer of 2015 have said that we need something very different. We need something that's a different point of view. And so Naomi Klein has said, the task is to articulate not just an alternative set of policy proposals, but an alternative worldview to rival the one at the heart of the ecological crisis. Mm-hmm. And Pope Francis says, we need to think about reality in a different way. And these kinds of people are saying this, and, well, we've got a new way of approaching reality in the immanent worldview of John Muir. We have an alternative worldview in Muir's Earth Wisdom and in Taoism mm-hmm. as well. So what we need to do post-haste is to discover these alternative ways of looking at reality to save ourselves. It's not just the Earth we need to save. That's a good idea. We should do that. But many studies by the World Bank, by PricewaterhouseCoopers, by the International Energy Agency, and these are not wild-eyed environmentalists. These are very sober and serious policy analysts, have come to the same point of the same conclusion that it's human civilization that, in fact, is threatened, and not in a distant future,
right?
But in several decades, perhaps, certainly 3 or 4 decades. And so our view now, and this is what I advocate strongly in Earth Wisdom. I mean, I look at Muir and I look at his adventures. I look at his worldview. I mean, that's fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's positive. But then I also look at what's happening these days. And our task now is to, I call it the three A's, to first of all articulate this different worldview. And whether you articulate Taoism or Earth Wisdom or some of the native peoples' cosmologies, it doesn't matter. It's the immanent worldview we've got to articulate. We've got to advocate for this worldview. That's the second A. And the third A, now we have to take action.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get enough people adopting these articulated and advocated new ways of looking at reality, then we can start keeping these fossil fuels in the ground and start charging ahead with the sort of urgency that we use in the first days of World War II, for example, in going to wind energy and solar energy and geothermal energy. Bill McKibben, the fellow who founded 350.org, wrote an article shortly after the UN climate conference saying, hey, folks, the starting gun has been fired. Why aren't we running full out to put up solar panels and to get sustainable energy sources? We've got to do this. And yet here we are a year and some afterwards, and really we haven't done very much.
Mm-mm.
And so that's why it's important for us to get a grip on what's going on, to articulate and advocate for this new way of looking at the world, which in fact is an old way of looking at the world, and to get our act together. And that is our task right now, I think.
How old are you?
I'm 72.
Are you a gardener?
I have gardened all my life, except for this year when I was so busy with this book and promoting this book that I didn't put the old garden in. But I have been a gardener virtually all my life, yes.
It's interesting because as I am reading the book and I the idea of plants and flowers and trees and botany is what that's my access point
yes.
to these theories and these philosophies. And I kept wanting to say yes, yes, yes. And it was interesting to me that the two perfected lords, which is the an anecdote or people that you use as your illustration of the Tao and Taoism, they were botanists. And right from the start, John Muir was a botanist, and he really wanted to find that Calypso orchid, and he really wanted
yes.
to find
yes.
these things. And but I think for me, and then there's that great again, like, you know, refrigerator quote of, you know, look into the flower. Every flower is a window into heaven. But it's an access point that is part of this whole. Like, you can't have the flower or the plant without the soil, without the water, without the microorganisms, without those glaciers, without the rocks, without, you know, this whole process. And it is it's those access points that we have to just keep pounding on, I think, because, you know, you get to the end of your book where there are two paths that you are offering readers. You are saying, we can go this way and still be here in 100 years and have our children and our grandchildren, or we can go this way and it is fire and brimstone. So take your pick. And that's a hard sell. We know that. That's why no one has, you know, had made much headway with that sell. But that is the reality of it. And we have to maintain optimism. But this idea of reframing that it's not about us and it's not about saving us, but saving us is part of the equation and it's part of the story, whichever way we're headed.